Steve Okereke, he's my baby. Hello, and welcome to Big Mouth, the weekly Met Gala of pop culture, where we're not going to talk about football and Liverpool's incredible achievements at all. This year's theme for the show is Blackpool Beach Realness. I'm Andrew Harrison. I'm wearing a puce Argyle Mankini by Dolce & Gabbana. And with me, I've got Sean Patton and the Anna Winter of the limited edition Sarah Records promotional T-shirt. Hello, Sean. How you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Did you cast a glance at the Met Gala pictures? Katy Perry dressed as a chandelier and Gaga doing the then all my clothes fell off routine?
I certainly did. The pictures are it, aren't they?
The pictures are it. It was quite entertaining as pop nutterdom goes. Janelle Monáe had four hats on.
She certainly did. I liked it that Katy Perry ditched the chandeliers to dress up as a hamburger for the party afterwards. And there's this footage of her getting the hamburger costume on as J-Lo wafts past her in a really patronising, horrible, arrogant way. It's fantastic.
She should have come as a hamdelier.
A hamdelier. That's a good idea. Copyright that on buyhamdelier.com right now. Our first guest today is very much in tune with the theme. He is Britain's most ruthlessly powerful music business journalist. He's the author of The Final Days of AMI, Selling the Pig. And he's representing in a Ballymena calfskin bustier designed by Larry Mullen Jr. It's Eamon Ford. All right, Eamon, how are you doing?
Hello, how are we?
What did you make of the Met Gala pics? And did you think, yes, that's what I want my famous people to look like?
Well, I was given homework to look at these things because this is one of these things that just does not ping up on my radar because I have many sartorial blind spots. And I didn't know what it was for. Well, like, what's the point of it? It was like, obviously, the theme was camp. And I think someone online described it as you've mistaken. Taking camp for just showing off.
Yeah. And well, it's the Met Gala, so the
what even is that?
I don't even dick. She puts it on, and right? It's to celebrate policing.
So, and why did they not all just come as the cop from the village people then?
I don't know. If it was David Bowie, you'd be all over it, saying this is brilliant. You'd go, I love this. Look at him; he's dressed as a super terrine or something. I don't know. Your book about the demise of EMI continues to get rave reviews around the entire universe.
But it's got four reviews.
There you go, four reviews. But we hear there's been complaints that there's not enough in it about the buildings.
Yes.
Give us the background here.
On Goodreads, someone gave it a 1-star review, which was brilliant, which was fair enough. But they felt that they wanted to find out more about the artist. Fair enough, but it's a business book, so that's another book. And they wanted to know more about the parties, which there is some reference to that. And then they wanted to know more about the building. But I don't know what if they wanted like a kind of architectural breakdown of EMI's assorted London offices. I don't know what they wanted. I mean, I could do that, maybe.
You could have done a quick chapter on the air conditioning or maybe the flooring.
Do you know what? I could have got my dad to do a gas chapter because he's a builder. He could have scored them like seven hammers out of town. So Big Eddie approved.
New extended edition bonus content.
Yeah, he'll put an extension on it.
Very nice. Also joining us behind the velvet rope of fabulousness is Mark Hooper, magazine veteran of The Face and Arena and writer for The Guardian. Mark is wearing an off-white Angora onesie by Karl Lagertop. Welcome back to Mark.
I'm always wearing my Lagertops.
So the Met Gala theme was camp. Do they know what actual camp is? Was it just raiding the dressing up box?
Yeah, well, Jared Leto turned up with his bare head. I don't see how that's camp. That's just like...
That's Zaphod Beale.
But yeah, it just seemed, I don't know, it seemed really misconceived because sort of this day and age, it just felt like, I don't know. I think it was obviously some sort of attempt at a kind of Me Too, LGBT maybe. Supporting, but it just seemed like, oh, let's just flaunt our wealth at everybody.
They should have been idiots. They should have brought some of those Marks & Spencer's LGBT sandwiches.
Throw them around.
Yeah.
Maybe someone did and that didn't get in the pictures. Lizzo was dressed as Big Bird, but a pink version looked like.
I thought Lizzo got the brief.
That's okay. We'll have that.
And then walked away with a coat, and there's footage on Instagram of her just walking into the airport lounge with the big coat on, just keeping it going. Marc Jacobs, I'm keeping this coat.
Did you see the caption on Lizzo's Instagram post? It said, black, fatty fashion. That's what she said about herself.
How did I miss that? That's amazing.
It is pretty amazing.
Queen. Yes. Mark, you've been secretly consulting on the Return of the Face, apparently.
Secretly, yeah, in disguise. I just sort of helped out with the setup and initially it was kind of no staff and I worked there. That's kind of my first proper job. So I was kind of helping sort of join the dots a little bit and not exactly recruiting people, but just as a sort of second opinion on people and then help them write a manifesto more kind of internally and because when I first spoke to them I said, you know, it's the face, you don't need a manifesto.
A manifesto? That's sorry.
A manifesto?
A manifesto. Yeah. But they were saying, yeah, that's all very well. When you have a meeting with, you know, Gucci or whoever it is, you kind of need to tell them who you are and what you're about. So it was kind of really trying to join the dots and explain to the new team what made the face different and their their editorial approach.
Do they need that explaining?
Well, you know what? They're great. They're really good. And, you know, it's quite hard to say without sounding condescending, but they're just a room of really smart, clever kids, and it's kind of really energising being around them. And I'm just full of positivity for it because I think they've totally got it, and it's really exciting what they're doing. And, you know, I don't understand half the stuff that's on there because I'm not the audience, but that's great. It's more like the editorial approach, which, you know, I always kind of explained it as the why, not the what. So it's like, don't tell me what's interesting, tell me why it's interesting. And that's exactly what they're doing. And, you know, the fact they're covering all the, you know, climate change marches and stuff, and see that, you know, their remit isn't just to talk about who, you know, Dave or whoever the coolest new rapper is. It's about what's happening in culture. So, you know.
Well, there's a lot of stuff happening. So
it certainly is.
And when's
seems
the first
a good
issue
time. Yeah, yeah, all the time.
When's the first issue out, papery version?
August. Okay. I think it's one of those sort of September issue out in August.
Yeah. Ooh, the September issue. Yeah.
But it's very much digital first as well, which is the other thing. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's completely, you know, it's an audience who, for most of them, it was, you know, Face has never been around because it closed.
Well, are the staff, did they grow up with Face in their sight line, so to speak, or not?
Well, so Stuart Brumford, the editor, he's great. He's slightly older.
Right.
And obviously in some of the staff. But yeah, I think it's a bit of a mixture. Some of them were, and
God, a room full of inspiring, clever young people. What a horrible thought.
None of that today.
None of that today.
I'm out.
I've had enough of that, yeah. On this week's show, we're going to be talking about Chernobyl, out this week on Sky and Now TV. It's a big budget dramatisation of the world's worst nuclear accident, featuring Jared Harris from Mad Men, Emily Watson, and Stellan Skarsgård from Thor. Does it work as drama, and does it make sense? Plus, want to feel old? It's 25 years since Ill Communication by the Beastie Boys came out and put their private world of terrible old American TV, blaxploitation movies and punk rock into the mainstream. How does it stand up today? And we're going to be looking at the comedy drama Eighth Grade, out now in cinemas, introducing us to the horror of American high school. Braces, BFFs, the whole lot. Should you go and see it? What's it like? Remember, listeners, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early by helping us to pay our studio bills on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Sign up for the price of a pint. That's £5, because why would a sophisticated individual like you drink anywhere cheaper? And we'll send you the show as soon as we've finished taking all the mistakes out. You'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. This week, Mark, Aim and Sean and I are going to select the albums that ought to be on the national curriculum and the ones that ought to be erased from the timeline in a Let's Kill Hitler fashion. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Right, let's start with the fun stuff. HBO's Chernobyl has just started on Sky and Now TV. It has the unenviable task of explaining a complex nuclear accident and keeping track of scores of Russian characters who, unfortunately, are going to die in large numbers and disappear from the screen. Should it be your next novelistic TV watch? Here's a taster.
All of the good we did. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that to them, justice was done. See, a just world is a sane world. There was nothing sane about Chernobyl.
I'm pleased to report that the situation in Chernobyl is stable. In terms of radiation, I'm told it's the equivalent of a chest X-ray.
No, Chernobyl is on fire. And every atom of uranium is like a bullet, penetrating everything in its path. Metal, concrete, flesh. Now, Chernobyl holds over 3 trillion of these bullets. Some of them will not stop firing for 50,000 years.
Tell me how to put it out.
You are dealing with something that has never occurred on this planet before.
Fade Away and Radiate, the HBO dramatisation of Chernobyl. This is an attempt to impose dramatic structure on a chaotic event, the meltdown in the reactor core at Chernobyl in Ukraine in April 1986, and then also the cover-up afterwards. This was, as I said, the world's worst nuclear accident, in which a badly designed plant, where corners have been cut in an attempt to show that Soviet nuclear technology could outpace the West, went terribly, terribly wrong. And in episode one, we see the accident and the immediate effect of plant workmen vomiting blood, losing their skin. It's basically a 1970s Doctor Who come true. Mark Hooper, is this dramatisation up to the task of explaining this extremely complex and unique event and also making it into a decent drama?
I thought so. I mean, it felt to me like they were really trying to do one of those sort of John le Carré, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier spy. So that had that sort of mood. That kind of, it was obviously
It's certainly got those curtains.
Mid-80s, yeah. It's kind of, you know, Russian and loads of smoking and very, you know, before the accident, very ill-looking people.
Yes. You know. They've all got radiation poisoning.
I mean, it was quite slow and there's a lot of... I think the sort of exposition was quite clever in a way because it's the setup of this sort of Politburo mentality where nobody would take responsibility and would only sort of, you know, go up the chain and then wait for someone to tell them what to do. Which is quite a good way of kind of then they could sort of explain because, you know, got to Gorbachev at the top and said, well, are you a nuclear physicist? And the guy was like, no. He's like, well, maybe you should go with a nuclear physicist and find out what's going on because basically everybody denies it and trying to cover their own arses. And, the beginning was really odd. I thought it was very strange. For all the drama, it was a very strange... I don't want to spoil what happens, but it's...
Well, I mean, I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that in episode one, it is total confusion, and we don't actually get to the central kind of character relationship between Jared Harris as the nuclear physicist and Stellan Skarsgård as the party boss until episode two.
And I think they're great in the second episode. They really... Because they sort of hate each other, but they kind of get this sort of mutual respect.
And to me, that was kind of attempting to inject a bit of sort of character drama into an event. I mean, I'd read the excellent book Midnight in Chernobyl by our old friend and colleague Adam Higginbotham, which is incredible. Yeah. And I think this series clearly draws on it quite a lot, or it draws on the material that goes into that book. So I was kind of pre-warned. But I should imagine that for somebody who wasn't up on their Chernobyl, it might have been completely, flatly confusing. Eamon, you were... I have advanced knowledge that you were not thrilled by Chernobyl.
I was not. I don't know. I only made through one episode, so maybe they kind of ramp up the lols in episode two. I find it really flat. Maybe was that the point? It just felt really... They didn't seem to have any rhythm. You've got a nuclear reactor that's got the core's blown up and it's panic and everybody just seems to be kind of scuffling around and nobody seems to be... I didn't want it to be Threads and kind of loads of people running, screaming and wetting themselves in a shopping street and things like that. But I just find it really unengaging. You have clearly an amazing subject to write about. You've got an amazing drama. I didn't expect it to be just kind of mushroom clouds everywhere and things like that. Yeah. But I just find the exposition just really slow and...
That, in a way, is... I suppose that's kind of what I liked about it, in that, like, it's not presented as a disaster movie. Mm. Nobody's running around saying, ticking clock. Nobody's, I'm the hero. Oh, here's the pointy-headed geek who's got us into the trouble that we're in, and here's this, you know, straight-laced guy's going to get it. All of those kind of tropes were completely subverted, I thought. Sean, what did you think of it?
I don't think those tropes were subverted in that there is a ticking clock, because we start at, what is it, 11 o'clock at night, and then...
Well, it kind of starts 2 years ahead.
Yeah. But then it goes 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. So you have that ticking clock element in that first episode.
Well, time's passing, but a kind of classic movie ticking clock is if we don't do something by this time...
Yeah, but I think this is the reversal of it, does a similar
thing.
Yeah,
I could have stopped it with 1 second to go as well.
Yeah.
But there is, it's 30 or 40 minutes where it's just about the accident and you don't have any cutaways to idyllic people walking around the grass, you know, or someone having a top-level meeting. All the things that usually you get in drama, you have a sharp contrast and then you go back to the disaster. There's none of that, so it feels really, really relentless. I found it really grim, really depressing. The kind of thing you make yourself watch is a lot of people, you know what's going to happen. People are being sick and all the authorities going, you know, everything's fine. And someone's just been sick next to you and is bright red. There's a part of me that just thinks, why do people want to sit through this? And also because we've done a few very serious, important dramas on this show. And there's a lot of them about. And I think there are going to be more. And I sometimes think doing this as entertainment, like Looming Tower last week, doing that as entertainment, what are we doing here?
I also struggled with it a little bit because they do it in English and they don't pretend to do the kind of comedy Russian accents. But obviously Death of Stalin did that and played that for laughs. So I was kind of watching it slightly through that lens, hearing all of these regional UK accents for people in Russia.
I think that's the correct decision, though. Because
absolutely, but I think because Death of Stalin did that, that kind of, that's the lens through which everybody else sees it.
One thing that struck me was that the exposition or the plot moments, rather than the kind of effects and large masses of people showing you the effects of the disaster, special effects, that is, The key moments where you actually see characters discussing stuff are really quite stagey. The bits in the nuclear power plant control room look like they should be on the stage at the National. Mm. The big confrontation in the party boardroom where everybody is so terrified to step out of line on communist orthodoxy, and what makes the decision and makes the wrong decision is a very, very old communist standing up and saying, well, the communist thing to do is this, have faith in the party, which leads them down a disastrous path that leads to many, many deaths. That, I thought, was a really powerful scene, but it did look like something that ought to be taking place in a theatre. Yeah. Rather than...
Well, I did like that sort of the staginess of it, because it did feel very Russian, and the fact that, you know, there's kind of no drama, but they said, everything's fine, carry on. They go, OK, and then you suddenly thought people start dropping like flies. And then there's a great scene where at one point one of the characters says to the other guy, we're both going to be dead in 5 years. And the coin hasn't dropped apart from to the scientists. And then when they realise that, it's in a way that's kind of more chilling, because the bloke just sits down and goes, oh, OK.
Well, I thought those threads, which I hope are going to get teased out later in the series, that the Stellan Skarsgård's character is a party bigwig who absolutely did not want to have anything to do with this. He's ordered to go along with the Jared Harris character to Chernobyl, not knowing that he's walking into a death sentence. And it shows you that the party bigwigs are exactly the same as the poor firefighters who were sent into, you know, the most powerful gamma field that's ever existed on the planet.
Without any protection at all, and just told to get on with it.
And what I thought was great was the way it uses tiny details, such as, you know, fireman picks up a block of something, puts it down. Half an hour later, you see his hand is melting.
True, apparently, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, they're rushing into the disaster area set and saying, little size, can you taste metal? Yeah. It's got a metal taste in there, isn't it? That's the ionisation of, you know, and the presentation of that, the kind of key effects bit, apart from the exploded kind of, you know, grand spectacle of the exploded reactor, is that column of light emerging from the burning reactor. That's true as well. That's the kind of the ionisation of the atmosphere. I thought that stuff was all really good, but you kind of had to know it before.
Yeah. I like the... Can we talk about the very first scene or not? Yeah. Well, I guess we can. Well, it's just the fact that it's set 2 years in the future and it's someone effectively kind of, I guess, spilling the beans on what happened to their recording, kind of their memories of it all. And then they go outside and hide these, like, half a dozen cassettes where they've kind of exposed what's happening. And I guess, okay, well, the whole thing's going to lead to that, to the expose. And I liked that, but then I just felt it dropped down several gears.
Well, I think that I'm betting that the cover-up is going to be more dramatically satisfying because it's about people.
Yeah, no, of course. But I like the fact that they planned it that very early on, but then it just went into the really boring bit, I thought.
Directed by Stackerbow as well, we should say.
Stackerbow?
Yeah.
Stackerbow?
Yeah.
Stackerbow. Yeah. Really? Yeah. Good Lord. I am going to go back and recommend Adam Higginbotham's book Midnight in Chernobyl, just for the detail. It explains everything, not just from kind of a nuclear physics point of view, but the political background. What this show can't do is tell you why there's a reactor in Pripyat, why it doesn't work properly, why the town has been built in such you could not have created a better environment for a mass nuclear disaster if you tried. And he goes through all of that. Also, the tone of the book, which I think the TV show sort of slightly captures, but the tone captures it much better, is it has that kind of weird, that very Russian, deeply alien feel of, like, Stalker, the Tarkovsky movie Stalker, where, you know, the governing tone of Russian imaginative fiction is total confusion and alienness. I think the book is brilliant on that. Would a drama documentary with a voiceover explaining what's going on have worked better, do we think?
I don't know. No one knows.
Possibly so. Who knows? Okay, well...
Only time can tell.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to stick with it. Mark, are you going to stick with it? I don't think
these
two are.
Yeah, I want to see the third episode.
I'm not watching anymore.
You're not watching any more grim stuff.
Life's depressing enough.
I'm going to stick with it. But listeners, read right now Midnight in Chernobyl by Adam Higginbotham instead or as well, because it will make total sense of this.
I might do that. Yeah. Right, I think we need to lighten the mood. Let's do it with some music. We always ask our guests to select a tune for the show, an editor's recommendation. Eamon Ford, what have you brought in for us?
Oh, I brought in Fontaine's DC, who are one of those modern Irish bands. They're allowed them after U2, after the great purges post U2, where they were all put in the gulag. It's a Dublin band, Fontaine's DC. The DC apparently stands for Dublin City. And they just put out their debut album a couple of weeks ago called Doggerel, which is very good. And I'm going to play a song called Boys in the Better Land, which was a single last year. They did a load of kind of set-up singles last year. And I think they are tremendous. And also the singer is a very unapologetic dub in his accent, not dub reggae, dub as in Dubliner.
Marvellous. Give it a listen. Boys in the Better Land by Fontaine's DC.
You're not alive, boy, so you start kicking when the room is spinning and the words aren't sticking. And the radio's on a better runaway model with a face like sin and a heart like a James Joyce novel. Saying sister, how I missed you, let's go wrist to wrist and take the skin off of a blister.
Sticking with unpleasant punk rock music, the Beastie Boys released their fourth album, Ill Communication, 25 years ago this month, and its massive success was Sweet Sweet Revenge for a band written off after their Paul's Boutique album failed to give the Fight for the Right, Your Right to Party audience what it thought it wanted. Full of jazz, funk and quasi-mystical Tibetan music, as well as their trademark serio-comic hip-hop stuff, it established the modern Beasties and they would never look back. And the record's aesthetic of American junk culture, especially in the Sabotage video, would create huge chunks of the pop culture future. Stay tuned for aging B-boy talk after the opening track, Sure Shot.
And B-girl.
And B-girl. Mark Hooper, this is quite radical stuff, but they'd had a dry run on Check Your Head, hadn't they?
And Paul's Boutique as well, wasn't it? Which was the sort of sophomore album.
Yeah, well, Paul's Boutique is the one where they haven't learned to play the instruments yet.
Yeah,
but Check Your Head is where they try.
It kind of
shows
like, well, these guys are kind of interested in something beyond being frat boy idiots, and you know, which is kind of. Yeah, I mean, I think this is the album where it all kind of coalesced, and yeah, I really remember it coming out, and everyone, even as you said, Check Your Head, I think particularly was kind of got a bit more critical acclaim, but.
Oh, you like their earlier stuff? Oh, okay, yeah. No, but you still work on the face, didn't you? Yeah.
I like them. Actually, funnily enough, I used to work with a guy who drummed for the Beastie Boys when they were a thrash metal band. You know, Simi Richmond.
Simi Richmond used to be in the Beastie Boys.
He brought in a signed single to prove it. He drummed for one gig because they got like a gig in a basement and they didn't have a drummer. So they said, hey, Limey, I hear you can play the drums. Okay. And he used to be in some really terrible sort of soft rock 80s band.
Good Lord. So well, listeners, if you used to be in the Beastie Boys, drop us a line.
Phone in.
We'll have you in. Phone in.
Beside the point.
I know, yeah. But the surprise on this one is they actually can't, not just that they've got instruments they can play, but they also kind of go off into these sort of jazz fusion excursions, don't they? Yeah. With names like, you know, Transitions and stuff like that.
To think that, you know, when the first album came out, to think that, you know, a few albums down the line, they'd be talking about Buddhism and sampling jazz tracks it's quite a transition.
Yeah. I mean, they've very much kind of realised this private world of where it's not just about the musicians that they love, but it's also like all the old stupid comedy records they love and, you know, the fast food joints and all those things. It's like it's a universe that's kind of brought into place, and they stop kind of caring about commercial considerations. I mean, I think the second thing you hear is a 1 minute punk song called Tough Guy. Yeah. And it's full of all these in-jokes. Like, there's a track called Futterman's Rule, which is an instrumental. And I discovered subsequently that Futterman's Rule is when three are served, all may eat. It's for the large family. It's when you've got your food dobbed out in front of you. Sean, what did you think of this on a re-listen?
I'm not a great Beastie Boys aficionado. They're kind of music in the background for me. I think I was doing something else when they were there. But also the problem is I came from Twickenham, and when Beastie Boys were massive, I mean, that's a problem in itself.
Yes.
When they were massive, when they first came over here and the Sun used to just trail them around and talk about how badly behaved they were, it was all women in bikinis. Mm. And them doing their faux sexist thing, to me from Twickenham, looked sexist. So I got them completely wrong at the beginning. I didn't get the irony, man. I wasn't in that place.
There was much irony to begin with.
Well, a lot of people have told me it's all ironic now.
Respective irony. Yeah.
Yes, maybe that's it. There's been revisionism
then.
I've been told
grew
off
up
for
and
that.
Felt a bit guilty. So then.
Yeah, and so I listened to this and thought, oh my God, it's amazing.
Oh my God, it's the funky shit.
Totally. I think it is incredible, actually, and worth more and more listens. It's of its time in that the sampling and then everything coming off and so many different reference points and so much going on within it. But in that, it's really dense and really enjoyable and really punk rock. There's a real fuck you element to it that, as you know, I always enjoy in records. I just thought, yeah, this is the shit, man.
This is the shit,
man. I texted my sister, who's more of a Beasties fan than me, and just she told me how much it was the shit for ages.
Yeah. One thing that I kind of I'd forgotten, because now we listen to everything on Spotify all the time, is how it sequences basically one gigantic funk jam for the age of the long CD. And you're never quite sure when a track ends or begins, because they're all punctuated by all these little skits and voices. Like, I want to get out about partying or anything and all this stuff. And it just feels like it's like a complete listen. Eamon, I can't picture you breaking and popping on a cardboard box outside the Ballymena Little.
It was it was a big scene then.
Was it?
Yeah.
Was it, west side of Ballymena? Fighting east side?
I don't think it has either. It's not big enough to have sides, Ballymena.
Was this a big record for you?
I hadn't listened to it for about 24 years.
Wow.
I bought it at the time. I paid top dollar for it on the compact disc format, which was all the rage back then, young people. And so I hadn't listened to it then. Obviously, Sabotage is a masterpiece, and there's no disputing that. And I was coming to it slightly wary, thinking this is really going to annoy me because I find their rapping style brilliant over singles, but over the duration of an album, it reminds me of why I don't have children. It's just constant noise. It's just endless yapping and noise.
You get used to that.
And, but I like the fact that it had all of these instrumental bits and the kind of the rhythm was broken up. So you were getting these little amuse-bouche or amuse-ear, I suppose. And I like that. I like the fact that there was a lot more kind of light and shade in the album rather than this kind of one note or one whiny note that you could get when you just listen to them kind of all rapping on top of each other. So I like the fact that they were able to kind of take a break and sit down and shut their yaps occasionally.
Yeah, similarly, I thought I was going to hate it. I thought this is New York hipster music. They've grown up. They're, you know, they're now going to be down with everything. They're going to be so woke and they're going to be doing a bit of sampling. It's going to be awful. And I really did think I didn't want to put it on because I thought this won't have aged well. So I surprised myself in that way.
Mm.
It's likeable.
Although, obviously, Sabotage is, when it comes on, it just roars out of the speakers more than anything else.
Sabotage did, and the video in particular, absolutely nailed I actually think it sort of slightly changed the direction of things because it sort of dragged all that kind of, bad 70s cop show stuff right into the limelight. And I don't think, without the Sabotage video, there's no Brooklyn Nine-Nine because that's basically Sabotage video of the series, isn't it? They've basically taken the Sabotage video, turned it into a series with the same sense of humour, with the same stupidity, with the same kind of love of crappy 70s cop shows, but also understanding how daft it is. Yeah, and Mark, you were on The Face at the time, weren't you? It's sort of
freelance.
Connected. I mean, considering the pecking order of cool at which they sort of entered very high as a result of this record, did you notice it changing the way people were dressing and the sudden influx of woolly hats and goatee beards and all that?
Yeah, well, actually, I also work for Acid Jazz, so there's a lot of that going on anyway. which is really interesting because I was real cross because Acid Jazz has got certain reputation for a certain type of music, but that for me that's exactly the music everyone was listening to, and it kind of there's a jazz element, but it's kind of mixed in with all this kind of it's what you do with that and what makes it interesting, and I do remember that there was a big interview with them and everyone came out saying they were absolutely impossible, and Grand Royal magazine was incredible. That's like I still go through those. I actually brought some in for the New Face to have a look at them. It was like the magazine they put together. Did about four over about a decade, I think, but they're made just crammed, crammed full of crazy ideas, brilliant. And the fact that they can put together a magazine like that and then not understand, how magazines
had to be
work
in somebody else's
and
magazine,
how to be interviewed and not be an idiot to the journalists as well.
Yeah, one thing I noticed on the re-listen was that quite a lot of it, I think, would probably be excoriated and slagged off if not for the Beastie Boys kind of brand name, because a lot of it does sound like Grand Funk Railroad or Chick Corea. If it didn't come with the Beastie Boys frame around it, people would be a bit more judgmental about it. But it kind of works because you're sort of never more than a couple of seconds away from it, like a sample going, if it's going to be that kind of party, I'm going to stick my dick in the mashed potato. And that was all these little triggers, or just the little trigger in sample that starts Fruit Loop, where it's just goes, who, me? And then you're right into the do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's all really kind of packed with those bits that undercut any kind of chin-stroking muso-iness. They went over hugely at Glastonbury that year. It was ludicrous. It was like the big thing, and they were out in the crowd and wandering around. It's hard to imagine an act like this happening now, isn't it?
I don't think so.
You think
you could well have the Beastie Boys now. Yeah. Why? Why do you think that it'd be hard now?
Because
they couldn't get away with the first album.
They couldn't get away with the first album. Because they are silly and ridiculous, and it's hard to get silly and ridiculous away these days, don't you think?
No, I think we talk about silly and ridiculous quite a lot. Confidence Man, silly and ridiculous. They're not Confidence Man.
They're great,
man,
but they're not. The Confidence Man are really good and we love them, but they're not on the scale. They didn't get any Billboard number one kind of thing. I don't know. I just think there's something kind of unruly about this that would be hammered out of it now. It would be kind of prevented.
Come from the underground. What I like about it is they're really trying to flip the braggadocio of the old albums and the I Am, I Am, and they turn into I Am, a Buddhist. it's far more revolutionary than it first appears, and so it is really, it's worth sort of digging deep into it, which is what I enjoyed the most about it. I could listen to it a few times this week.
Yeah. I have realised after 25 years that the track Flute Loop is a joke on Fruit Loop. 25 years, and it's like staring you in the face. There you go. Anyway, ill communication. We like it. And also, whatever you type out, it looks like three communication.
Yeah, or aisle communication.
Aisle communication.
Does to
thank you, also correct.
They predicted the problems of text.
Yeah. Right, let's get back to the present day. Mark Cooper, I believe you brought in a track for us.
Yes, I have. It's called Social Media by This Elegant Gull. Gull as in seagull.
Not That Elegant Gull, This Elegant Gull.
Yes, specifically. And I think we're going to talk about this a bit later, but it's by a little girl, I think about 11 or 12, and I know her dad, who basically produced this track, but it's not one of those things. He's not like a big name or anything.
Music just happens, business.
He lives in the woods, and he's like, you know, but he knows how to record music. That's it. And this, I know for a fact, she wrote all of this herself, arranged it, told her dad where he wanted all the bits, and he just put it together. They sent like didn't you know he's not in the music industry, didn't put any strings. Sent it into they had a Six Music talent thing. Tom Robinson picked up on it. They played it. He sort of playlisted it as one of his favourite tracks. Amy LeMay's played it as well. And it's great. It's almost like what the Pet Shop Boys are trying to do with their social media song, but sung by someone who's actually living it. And it's basically, you know, it's just a kid saying, stop, you know, get off your phone, stop using social media. But I love the way it's got this real kind of sort of raw punkiness to it and sort of, you know, post-punk sort of mood.
Great. Mm. Social Media by This Elegant Gull.
Click another one posted. Click and get in the hang of this now. Getting followers, so matches now. How many likes do I have? Heart another one like ya. Heart, I seem so popular. Like my pictures, I'll follow you if you do. Heart, or your fave, or your fave. You've got the wrong idea on social media.
That was very appropriate, wasn't it? Eighth Grade is the first feature from Bo Burnham, who is, gasp, a YouTuber and comedian. It's the new generation, kids. Starring Elsie Fisher as 13-year-old Kayla Day, it shows a teenager during her last week at middle school before high school looms. She's in a world where normality is social media. Adolescent worries about looks, boys, grades and fitting in. Eighth Grade is not quite a coming-of-age movie, not in my mind, not quite Clueless or even Grease neither. It features the well-charted waters of that in-between stage between childhood and adulthood. But does it say something different? Here's the trailer.
Hey guys, it's Kayla back with another video. So, the topic of today's video is being yourself. Being yourself can be hard, and it's like, aren't I always being myself? And yeah, for sure. But being yourself is like not changing yourself to impress someone else. A lot of people like call me quiet or shy or whatever, but I'm not quiet.
Most quiet, Kayla Day.
I don't talk a lot at school, but if people talk to me and stuff, they'd find out that I'm like really funny and cool and talkative.
By the way, I like your shirt a lot. It's like so cool. What?
I said one more week of eighth grade, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, huh?
Okay, so growing up can be a little bit scary and weird.
We will begin to explore these changing bodies of yours. It's gonna be lit. Don't hold back.
I wanna break free. As always, make sure to share and subscribe to my channel. Gucci!
I think you're so cool. Maybe you just need to put yourself out there a little.
I'm gonna stop eating with you if you keep doing this.
You said I could say one thing.
I'm really like nervous all the time. I try really hard not to feel that way.
But you just need to face your fears and let people know they're really you.
Eighth Grade, which is hopefully at a cinema near you. Elsie Fisher plays teenage Kayla and provides the performance that carries everything and everyone with it. Mark Hooper, did this bring back the joys of adolescence to you?
Oh man, I absolutely loved it. I was actually quite shocked how much I liked it because, you know, it doesn't bode very well, a YouTuber's debut film. I've got a daughter who's just turning 9 next month. And actually, I said, well, I saw this at the cinema when I left. A random dad stopped and just started talking to me about it again. Isn't that incredible? And it's exactly what it's like, all the fears you have about your daughter growing up, but it feels like it's made by the girl. It doesn't feel like it's made. That's the thing that really amazing. Not the fact that, you know, it's a debut by a 28-year-old YouTube blogger, but he managed to get inside this girl's head brilliantly and also have the sort of maturity to sort of to communicate what feels like for a dad who's really concerned. He's obviously a great guy. There's a bit of mystery about where the mum is. I think they've either split up or she's dead or something. But he can't really communicate to her, and he's trying to do the right thing, but he doesn't want to get in the way. It just really moved me a lot.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Elsie Fisher's performance? Because she is almost
she's
in every
great,
scene.
Yeah, and totally natural. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's scripted, and she says like every other word.
Yeah,
and probably am as well. Yeah. But yeah, it was great, and it's got that sort of. I mean, she's totally insecure, wants to get in with a cool crowd, and then she's got this kind of blog she's doing where she's kind of giving tips and being really confident, and it's like
YouTube
a persona.
Vlog, yeah.
It's really clever. Yeah, yeah. Really great, and I love the fact that she meets this old. They have an exchange when you're going to middle school, and you have a mentor who spends a day showing them around. Just a cool older kid who's just that much older, knows all this stuff, doesn't matter. And it's great. She's got this kind of figure to look up to. And it's not all sweetness and light and some bad things happen, but it's great. Like that film, you came out with a good feeling about it. You know, I was expecting something terrible to happen and a few bad things happen, but you come out basically thinking she's going to be all right. Her dad's pretty cool, and she's got these older kids who are looking out for her. Yeah, it's great. It really made me feel better about my own daughter.
Andrew, some of these tropes are standard. They are the fitting in, feeling uncomfortable, having an enormous crush on a hunk, having to go to a swimming pool. Where was there when you're 13? How does it do it differently, do you think, 8th grade?
I think what it does is... you're absolutely right, because all those things are... They are the obstacles and challenges that everybody must face in their adolescent years. So, yes, the tropes are standard because they have to be faced. The way that it's different is... Obviously, the context of social media makes it very different because you kind of... she's making these videos where she's sort of presenting herself as if she's talking to the world, but at the bottom of the screen you can see one view, zero views, three views, zero. She's really talking to herself, and she's trying to convince herself the kind of person that she wants to be, which I found really, really moving and really kind of really choking, actually. And you see around her mirror in her bedroom, she's got these little post-it notes with these little affirming things.
Yeah.
And one of them says, "Never give up." And I just, like, that really got to me. Not least because that is the T-shirt that Mohamed Salah was wearing last night. And I thought, this is a message to me from the universe.
Yeah.
But I thought never give up bit always really gets to me, because I think that's, you know, whether it's a kid in high school or whether it's, you know, the way I prefer to experience emotional issues, which is through Avengers Endgame, for instance, the same core thing. You know, are you going to give up or are you not going to give up? Mm. And I think you see her, in her own way, these little school challenges, these little horrible, you know, the horrible popular girls that she runs into, and the indifferent, you know, friends who aren't really there, and the weirdos. You know, the challenge is every bit as great, and, you know... As she's in every scene, and as we hear effectively her internal monologue given through YouTube, you really feel it. And I actually thought it was brilliant. It's sold as a comedy, and it is funny, but it isn't really a comedy. It's putting you in the head of what it's like to be 14 years old again in a slightly different context.
Mm-hmm. I love the way there was no sort of sheen of irony. Like, I was almost expecting that kind of Wes Anderson Rushmore sort of thing, where it's all a bit. You know, and the geeks triumph over. But there's none of that. It's just this is just what it's like. To
well, there
kids,
was a,
you know?
There was a trailer for an upcoming movie called Booksmart, which is
I saw the trailer.
Yeah, which is two girls who are the flip of this character. They're really clever. They're really ironic. They are outsider loser types. But this is going to attack those issues by their wit, their humour, their ridiculousness, like a kind of like a female teenage sabotage video. The complete flip side of it. But I found this much more. I don't know because I haven't seen the other one yet, but I found it really, really affecting because I thought it was really true. Even though I've never been a 14-year-old American girl,
I was going to check.
I have.
Mark did mention there are a few points when it seems that the film is going to go into some dark places. Mm. And there's a really uncomfortable scene where she is in the back of a car. She is given a lift by an older boy.
Yeah.
And I thought, I really don't want this to go that wrong. And it's kind of saved without giving too much away. But I thought that it was the balance between not quite going there, but the fears of being a teenager are more than what happens.
And I think
to
what's
you.
Great about that is that, you know, not give time, but there's an older kid involved, slightly older. And it even got that sense like he's just a little kid as well. And he's just trying to this is what he thinks you're meant to do, and he's a bit nervous. And they're obviously, he's obviously a virgin too, but he's trying to act like he isn't. And it's, yeah, it's really subtly done. Yeah.
He's very much in the Napoleon Dynamite idea of, like, I'm going to be cool.
Yeah, exactly.
But I have no idea what
that is. I found him still quite, you know, I found him a little bit.
Oh, he's creepy, yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's creepy. It was realistic because, you know, when you go to school, things like that happen, and, you know, it kind of.
By the way, we're only leaving Eamon out because he hasn't seen it.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I've made my excuses. I was on a Dutch excursion of the weekend.
To Dutch.
Is that a euphemism?
Yes, it is. It's always, you put Dutch as a prefix to anything and it makes it filthy.
Yeah.
They only have filthy cinemas over in Holland. Yeah. But what I can offer as a new cultural and technological insight is, and I don't know if this is new, I was just speaking to Mark before we went on air, listeners, and going through Schiphol Airport on the way back, you don't have to take any of your stuff out of your hand luggage, laptops, toiletries, any of that stuff. It just goes straight through the scanner.
Wow, there you go.
So I don't know if that's a Schiphol-only experience or if this is going to be a vision of the future, but it's tremendous.
Well, the more you know.
There you go. Every day's a school day.
Every day's a school day. Yeah, anyway, back to 8th grade.
Back to the movie. There is an incredible scene with a terror school drill.
A school shooting drill.
Schools, yes, where a teacher has to pretend to be a masked gunman and some of the students have to pretend to be in the way and the others are just watching to see what you do. And you thought, fucking hell, being a teenager is so scary. Yeah. I forgot it just is so scary, whatever era you're in. Mm. And all those little details,
the teacher kind of enjoys it.
Yeah, it's like a comedy bit.
Being a teenager is both terrifying and boring at the same time.
And having this drill where they turn the lights off and they've got her under their desk and she takes that as an opportunity to go and chat up the guy she fancies.
I know,
I thought when you said drill, it was going to turn into like Driller Killer or something. I'm very excited.
No, well, just a practice.
Right, very clear from early on that at no point is she going to get bitten by a radioactive spider. Just know that she's a special vampire slayer wizard or anything like that. It's like it is suburbia times a billion, and the tiny challenges of suburbia every bit is huge and insurmountable as you know.
Well, even though I haven't seen it, I'm going to watch it.
It is a wonderful film. I liked it so much more than I thought I would going there. You identify with this 14-year-old girl, and it is also, I think, one of the sweetest films I've seen. The sweet in a genuinely really heartening way, and you come out and you just think, humanity's not lost, is it?
So this is showing in about like 6 cinemas,
yes,
isn't it? But
is it very kind of lo-fi in terms of the filming, or is it kind of big and glossy and slick?
It hops into kind of bits of YouTube and sort of montage things, but actually it's quite there's quite a gloss to it, isn't it? It's quite the soundtrack is brilliant.
Yes, the soundtrack is wonderful. The way music is used is really good.
Is kind of, it's really kind of grand electronica, really kind of you know.
And Enya.
And Enya. Enya's on there as well, as you will have heard on the trailer, a bit of Enya. But there's loads of banging electronica that dramatises these tiny little moments. And, you know, the fact that there's a kid walking across the back of a classroom that she fancies is accompanied by this.
How does it compare to something like Kids then? Is it that kind of vibe or not?
I haven't seen Kids.
It's not dark.
Right, okay.
Kids, you come out, you want to want a shower when you leave.
Yeah,
you really do. Yeah.
That's why I didn't get to see it.
And it also says social media isn't the devil. It's part of your life, but you could sort of learn to live with it.
If you're on social media. So I think the listeners need to put this on their Amazon or other wish list for when it comes out.
Yeah,
on DVD.
It will be streamed soon.
Yeah,
so yes, it's a wonderful film.
It is an absolute belter. Okay, pay attention, old people. We are coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guest be discussing over a glass of radiation-dispelling people's vodka down at the Pripyat Wetherspoons? Because you do find out in Chernobyl that Russian people thought that drinking vodka would keep radiation at bay. Heartbreakingly sad. Closing time chatter. Mark Hooper, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
It's an app called People in Space, which is so brilliant and simple. It literally tells you how many people are in space. You click on it and it pops up. So at the moment there's 6.
Yeah. Okay. Does it tell you who they are?
Yeah. So it'll just come up. It thinks about it and it's got a picture of the world from space and then it just come up with a number. So it's quite exciting because it was 3 until a couple of months ago. Now there's 6.
6.
Because having a changeover.
So how does that play for kind of home security basis? Because if you can just look somebody up and find out they're in space, you can go and like nick their MacBook.
I think they sort of advertise the fact they're astronauts in space anyway. But then you click through and you can see profile of each person. It's basically like a Wikipedia entry and a photo of them. But then you can scroll through and you can see all their own social media.
Oh.
So it's all their photos from space while they're up there. It's so amazing. It's really simple, but it's quite nice,
You could almost call it Spacebook. You could call it Spacebook.
If you're that way.
Is this available on... It's just
an app. It's called People in Space. Just look it up on the App Store. Yeah, and it's great.
Can you be able to contact them through the app?
There's a Twitter account, so you could tweet them. I'm not on Twitter, but
they've got other things to do.
You know
people
what?
Going, yeah, you're in space.
Excuse me. space is boring. Everybody who's been to space says there's a lot of downtime.
Would they just reply going, I can see your house from here?
I can see everybody's house from here.
Oh, look, you're naked, sunbathing in the garden.
Absolutely. Oh, well, no, that's next door. Eamon Ford, what's your closing time chatter, please?
I've been thinking a lot about this because it's been annoying me, like everything annoys me. But it's about how terrible some professional actors are and how they how they should not be allowed to get away with it. And it's kind of coincided because I obviously have watched Coronation Street for many, many years and Game of Thrones as well, and it got me thinking about that idea that was popularised by Malcolm Gladwell, that idea of the 10,000 hours and you kind of become an expert. And I was doing a bit of digging, it came from a psychology paper called The Role of Deliberate Practice in the Acquisition of Expert Performance. But it's the idea that you put the hours in and you can become good at something, and then there's that extra little bit of genius that flips you over. And then I was thinking, Ken Barlow has been on Coronation Street since 1960, and the man still cannot act. He's genuinely the worst professional actor I've ever seen. And then, when I was watching Game of Thrones, which has run for 10,000 hours, people like Jon Snow and Mrs. Dragons, whose name I always forget because I just call her Mrs. Dragons, they're among the worst. They're in one of the biggest shows in the world, and they're terrible, terrible actors. So I'm wondering at what point does someone maybe stage an intervention and go, this isn't for you, it's just not working out?
I think Mrs. Dragons can act. Jon Snow is very...
He's terrible.
He just furrows his brow, doesn't he? And goes, yeah. I don't like
But then king. On the flip side of that, you've got an amazing, generally amazing ensemble cast in Game of Thrones, how amazing. Coronation Street can do that kind of... They can do that kind of bittersweet thing. They can do the high humour. And they've got these very versatile actors. And then you've got Ken Barlow, who's just terribly, terribly wooden.
Given that...
And it's not like he's been, all of these people, all of these great characters, he's seen them up close. Mm. He's seen the tricks and he hasn't learned anything.
Being
it's amazing. It's like commitment to the mediocre cause.
Maybe it's almost, an art thing.
It is. You know? Maybe. Yeah. Maybe it's method acting. Yeah.
Well, get it. Enter Ken Barlow for the turn of
yeah, yeah. Do you not think in real life some people just can't do real life and they look like they're acting themselves badly? Yeah. So maybe he's doing that. Maybe that's the character.
Even his big kind of dramatic, or in the 80s, the kind of Deirdre and Mike Baldwin love triangle. Even then, he was rubbish.
Do you think then that given it's probably a bit late for Ken Barlow to get a further 10,000 years in, perhaps just a job swap with Jon Snow would do the trick? So Ken could be king in the north and Jon Snow could hang around in the Rovers in that reeking filthy fur thing.
Yeah, yeah, be having a half. He'd be having a half in the snug.
And, do they still do Betty's Hot Pot?
They do,
He'd have that to warm up from Wintersville.
He would.
Wintersville. From, like, Frosty Town.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's the next
They take you to Frosty Town.
Yeah, the Game of the Thrones with those big flying lizards. Yes, anyway. Well, it'll be all finished soon and you can stop looking at
Jon Snow. Coronation Street, don't break my heart.
Have you not seen the finale of Coronation Street? The dragon.
Yeah, a dragon.
Yeah, but there's a coffee cup in the middle of it.
By the way.
From Costa. That's an in-house reference to the fact that there is product placement in Coronation Street.
Did we see
they've got a Costa and a co-op.
Did we see, by the way, that after the picture of the coffee cup appeared in Game of Thrones, a listener to the show, Stuart Outen, put up a picture of Line of Duty with a gigantic drinking horn on the table and he said, it's a real blooper here as a drinking horn of giant's milk appears on the desk in Line of Duty. And somebody tweeted him and said, I'm so sick of hearing about Line of Duty. Lots of us aren't watching it. That's not the joke, mate. The joke is. Anyway, Sian, what's your closing time chatter?
Okay. I read the Shane Meadows interview in The Observer by a friend of the show, Miranda Sawyer, at the weekend, and I just read it open-mouthed. I haven't read an interview like that for ages. I was just stunned by Shane Meadows' honesty about his history. It was just incredible. It was a fabulous piece, and you can now obviously go and look at these things. It's in the Observer archive, even though it's a few days old. It was just incredible. All of it. Go and read it. It was just fantastic. Shane Meadows is a king amongst men. But I think my favourite bit, and it's about the abuse of him as a child and how it goes into his work and all sorts of things. I feel a bit fizzy even talking about it now. But the end of it, I thought the coda to it was so important. And I keep going back and reading it because I'm sad. But I just wanted to talk, you know, there's so much Met Gala and everyone dressed as Fozzie Bear. We have this celebrity culture. It's around us. Sometimes it's just fucking shit. And he says... What he wants to do with the series, The Virtues, which is on Channel 4 very soon, he says, other than make a great piece of art, is to emphasise how heroic it is for some people just to live a normal life. I don't think we should be celebrating who's made the FTSE 100, he says. You don't know why a tramp is what he is. For some people, just to lead a sober life is heroic. Way better than running a conglomerate or making political decisions. And I just thought that's amazing. And we need more of that because everybody gets, you know, fluffed up and ballooned up and it's so-and-so and they're worth so-and-so and they're famous and this. It's not just that. Real life is something that happens underneath this.
But also that is eighth grade,
isn't it? Such an important thing to say.
That is eighth grade. That kid in eighth grade. That is like the heroism, just like trying to be.
Just trying to get through a day sometimes is hard for some people.
But like being yourself is like hard to be yourself because when you're being yourself, that's just the way she talks, isn't it? When you're trying to be yourself.
It's a wonderful, wonderful piece. Really important. And Shane Meadows is saying really important things.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, my closing time chatter is a massive bring down. Have you seen the Skoda advert with Paloma Faith in it?
I saw a bit of it, yeah.
Paloma Faith. And also Lady Leisure, who I like, and some indie bands who I'm not really sure who they are. And I think the London Gospel Choir in there. And it's like, it's a car advert. So, you know, fair enough. Artists have to pay their rent somehow. But the centrepiece is Paloma Faith kind of walks into this giant set surrounded by Skoda cars in this amazing ball gown. And you think, so far, so advert. She appears to be trailing this kind of black substance behind her from the ball gown. It looks like crude oil. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? In a car advert, the very last thing you need to be doing is reminding people about filthy fossil fuels and having Paloma Faith floundering around like an oil-covered seabird soundstage.
Are you sure it's just not a giant skid mark?
What a horrible thing to say. I don't know what the art statement is supposed to be, but I'm amazed that A, whomever was signing off on the storyboarding of this and go, lads, does she really, really need to be like trailing a load of, impacted mineral slime around the studio? Can't she just float around in a lovely frock? That's what we wanted to do. We got on with a lovely frock. Does she have to leave this kind of black trail of Exxon Valdez pollution? It's a bloody car advert. Also, don't make people think about that.
On the dress, is it too big for her to get into the car without assistance as well?
Yeah, but that's okay. I can suspend the disbelief. I can believe.
Maybe put her on the roof rack.
I can believe that somebody's going to sing a song about a car and it's going to make them feel like themselves. I can believe Lady Leisure doing her bit. I can believe whoever the indie band is. I can't believe anybody let through a reference to crude oil in a car advert. Unless it's an electric car advert, in which case I've missed it completely and it fails at that level too. But it's like, did nobody spot this? I'm amazed. I don't understand it. And I feel like I am somehow missing something out here.
Maybe there's a giant Starbucks coffee cup on the side as well.
Maybe there is. Well, I'm so Extinction Rebellion that I notice these things. Anyway, we've come to the end of the show. Patreon backers, the extra bit will be with you soon, in which we're going to choose which records ought to be on the national curriculum and which ought to be scrubbed out of the historical record using time travel technology. Mark Cooper, thanks for coming in. The print face is coming out in August.
Yes.
What else is happening? What else have you got on the go?
So I used to edit a magazine called Hole and Corner about sort of craftsmanship, so high-end craftsmanship. We did a book with Pavilion Books, which is out this week. Yeah. So we've got a launch party this week as well, which is really exciting. It's about the story of tools. So it's 25 of the best kind of makers of various industries in the world, all talking about the tool they couldn't live without. And it's kind of some of it's quite tongue-in-cheek. So we've got Jim Parkin from Aardman Animation talking about, because obviously there aren't specific described tools for doing clay animation, so he just uses whatever he can. And really famous furniture maker who talks about using his Black & Decker power drill and stuff. So it's not all completely worthy and stuff, but it's really interesting. But it's all about, you know, the process of creativity, I suppose.
So it's basically privatised me and my spoon.
Exactly.
Eamon Ford, when can people hear you explain the demise of AMI next? Have you finished your world tour?
I have, hopefully. God, I hope I have. I've been wanging on about it too much. I've got nothing in the diary. Oh, well, it's all terribly, terribly quiet. Terribly boring.
They'll have to buy the book instead then.
They will, yes. It was read. I read a piece in Rolling Stone and Ed O'Brien had said he'd just finished it the other week. So, and I haven't been sued yet, so that's fine.
But he looked at himself in the index, didn't he?
His argument was that they didn't realise how kind of important they were within EMI. He said, we just saw ourselves as another band within EMI, and nobody said, you're really important to the company.
holding the roof up.
I think when the negotiations were happening and the amount of money that was being talked about, I think that it was very much understood that they were very important to the company.
Good Lord. Well, everybody, go and buy Eamon's book about EMI. There's an unlimited supply. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to Sean and to producer Sophie Black, and we'll see you all next week. And did I mention that Liverpool won the most amazing football match in history?